Okay, and I actually think this is recording. Okay. So, welcome those of you who are here live and also those who may be tuning into this after the fact. This is the first office hours session for Austrian Economics 1, which is a study of Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. We're going through the first four chapters in this class. And this is, as I say, office hours one for week one, and we're just going to, I'll just turn it over to the people who are in the room at this point. So if you guys have any questions, go ahead and just start, you can just type them right in this chat box, because there's only a few of you right now. If it starts to get out of hand, we'll switch to the forum. But right now, it's fine if you guys have any questions right out of the gate. So just type it right in. And also, for those of you who have a question, but it's not the tip of your tongue, be thinking about it, because this happens in these things where people freeze up, and then I have to start singing Sinatra in order to fill the airtime. So if you don't have a question right now, be thinking of one, so that when the next one is answered, you can hit me with something. While some people are thinking here, let me just say some general remarks, but again, the moment anyone has a question, go ahead and type it in. This WebEx, just so you guys know, we switched over the quick answer, why did we switch from DIMDIM to WebEx, in case some of you are wondering who've taken previous classes. The quick answer is because DIMDIM got taken over by some other company, and they were going to discontinue the kind of service that, you know, having us as a client. So, you know, that's a pretty good reason to switch. I'm just trying to, somebody else joined us, and I'm trying to let that person in. Beyond that, though, it's actually advantageous that it happened. It's a good thing. It happens a lot sometimes with people, with things in life. You know, something goes the wrong way, and you're mad at the time, but then later it turns out to be good. Same thing here. This WebEx is infinitely better than DIMDIM once we get over the hurdles of getting all logged in and getting everyone up and running and hearing me and seeing me. For example, I can do like a live whiteboard. All right. So later on in the course, when we're getting into the supply and demand curves and stuff, I can just be drawing that, and you can see me build up the curves, and I can make observations. Whereas if you guys took me for principals last semester or in the fall, I had to just show static PowerPoints that way, and so it was harder to show you the evolution of a diagram. So anyway, just stuff like that. This is WebEx really is a lot better, although it's a little bit clunkier to get going. Okay, so, and for those of you who have just joined us, if you please be thinking of questions and have them ready so that we can just keep flowing through once we get going. All right, so Jack says, is there an audiobook version of Man, Economy, and State? That's interesting you ask that. There is a guy in, he's either in England or Australia. I don't know. It's one of those two places. I don't remember which. And he was going to start doing it. He's taking this class right now, and he has done audio recordings for the Mises Institute for some other books. I think he didn't. He might have done Chaos Theory for them, because that's how I know him. I think he did something that I did, and I think it was Chaos Theory, but I could be mistaken. And so anyway, he's got a cool, you know, audiobook guy voice, and you know, he could be Optimus Prime if he wanted to for Halloween and get away with it. So he offered to do it. He emailed me before this course started and said, hey, do you want me to, you know, if I can keep up with it, do you want me to do the audio recordings, and then, you know, we could post it that week with the material so the students could either read it or just get the audio, you know, listen to it in the car or something. So he started, and so I said, yeah, that'd be great. And then he said, wait a minute, I just found out that, what's that guy? Oh, man, drawing a blank. The guy who did the, for the zombie, interview with the zombie, that guy, Riggenbach, he apparently has already done the first chapter of Man, Economy, and State. And so then this other guy that I know didn't want to, you know, be doing it if somebody else is doing it. So he's just checking in to see what's the status of that. Is Riggenbach actually going to do it, or should this other guy do it right now? So I don't, I haven't heard back from him. So the point, there's a long way to answer your question. Yes, somebody is thinking about doing the audiobook. It doesn't exist yet, but somebody wants to do it in real time as we're going through this. But he's just making sure that he's not reinventing the wheel. So hopefully, let me just jot a note to myself because I forgot about to check in with him. So I'll let you guys know either way what's going on with that. But hopefully that means going forward, like as we do week two, week three, that stuff will become available as an audiobook format. Okay, Dennis Foster says, can you confirm that diagram 4 is in error with regard to the value of X4 and Y3? The first example implies that the value of Y3 is higher than X4, although the diagram shows them as the same. Okay, let me pull that up. Are you using the Scholar's Edition? And if so, can you tell me exactly what page number you're on? So if anybody else has a question, go ahead and post it, because it might take me a minute, Dennis, because I have to go look at those diagrams, and off the top of my head, it's not like, oh yes, that diagram is wrong. I'm not sure. So if someone else has a question, go ahead and post that while I post this up. And Dennis, if you can tell me which page, so page 26. So you're saying diagram 4 is in error. Let me see. So I've got another PDF up here. Hang on a second. You're talking about figure 4 on page 30? Is that what you guys are talking about? Or am I mixed up? Yeah, it's got to be what you're talking about, right? Okay, so now I see what you guys are talking about. Let me just see here. Okay. So you're saying the value of Y3 should be higher than of X4. The value of Y3 should be higher than X4. If I'm looking at this right, I think it's correct, right, Dennis? Isn't it saying with your notation, you're saying Y3 means the third unit of good Y, and X4 is the fourth unit of good X. If that's what you're saying, and you're saying the example says that Y3 should be higher than X4. So if I look on this Y3, so quantity of 3 on the Y, and you go up, and that's ranked third. And the X4, if you go up, that's ranked fourth. All right, so yeah, they're on the same they line up the same, like moving from your eyes left to right, they're the same distance from the bottom of the page. That's true, but if you look at the numbers on the left-hand axis, the right one is rank 3 and the left one's rank 4. And so that's the end. So it's showing that Y3 is the third ranked end, whereas X4 is the fourth ranked end. So since the third ranked end would be more valuable than the fourth ranked end. Does that work for you? So let me say it again in other words, okay, now that I see what's going on here. And then if you guys are looking, so everybody, we're at the, especially for people online too, or listening to this after the fact. So if you look at the diagram on page 30, it's figure 4 value scales. This is what we're talking about. And so Dennis's concern is, he said, in terms of the text and the way Rockford's talking about it, it looks like the third unit of good Y should be more valuable than the fourth unit of good X. And yet, if you look at these diagrams, if I'm understanding Dennis's confusion, it looks like they're the same height in terms of moving from the bottom of the graph going upward. It looks like they're the same distance from the x-axis, if that's the way you want to think about it. So if you were graphing a function, it looks like they're both the same height from the floor. And so Dennis is saying, doesn't that make it look like they're the same? They have the same value when Rockford was suggesting that the third unit of good Y would be more valuable than the fourth unit of good X. So I don't think that's what these diagrams are saying, because if you look at what the Y-axis is, it's saying the ends ranked. And so this is actually a good point, that notice the okay, now I see what you guys are getting at. Okay. Yeah, I see what you guys are talking about. So there is and there isn't a mistake. So if you're just looking at the numbers, then yeah, you would look at okay. Yeah, hang on a second. I don't want to. You're right. This is confusing. Right. I see what you guys are saying now. That does look confusing. Because yeah, Rockford's trying to say. Okay. So let me say for sure what we can say about this, and then I'll try to address your confusion. Now, you're right. I do see why this might be a little bit off. Just to give you, keep you guys not in suspense, I'm not going to say right now definitively, yes, this is wrong, because I should really go and, I did read this stuff before, but I wasn't really looking carefully at this particular diagram, to be honest with you. So I was reading the text, which all made sense, and I didn't check to make sure it meshed with this diagram, so I don't want off the top of my head tell you it's wrong in case it's right. I'll come back to you afterward and clarify if it's a mistake, but let me just walk through to make sure we get how this is working. So yeah, he's saying here that look at these. So good Y, the first through seventh units, he's showing the rankings, and yeah, it looks like the way, if you wanted to combine the two, the thing that's most important is the first good unit of good Y, and then the thing that's the next most important is the first unit of good X, and then the second unit of X, and the third unit of X, and then the second unit of Y, and then it flips back to. And then that's where you guys are confused, right? Because you're saying, wait a minute, after the second unit of good X, what's the next thing in line? Because it looks like it's both the fourth unit of X and the third unit of Y. Because for everything else, it's clearly one or the other. It flips back and forth. So yeah, you guys, I'm tentatively going to agree with you and say that looks like it's a mistake and that there should be an extra space in there to so that you know which way it alternates if you're going to go through the ranking of these two goods in terms of their units. Is that, am I saying what you guys agree with? Like that was the issue? So for sure, this confuses me now. So that should reassure you guys if it confused you. And I will double check this and then tell you for sure one way or the other. Like I said, right now it does look like it's a mistake, but I don't want to say definitively. Just so you guys know, there are a lot of mistakes that crept into this, both, I think, going from the old edition to the Scholar's Edition and then also going from the physical book to the PDF with some of these diagrams. And it's unfortunate, and they thought they caught most of them. But the point is, a lot of this stuff is not something that Rothbard did. It's that people after the fact were, you know, reformatting it and trying to update it and put it in different fonts and stuff, and then sometimes copying the graphs over, you know, the people who were dealing with the graphs might not have understood why it was a certain way in the first one, and that, you know, they changed it not thinking it was an innocuous change. And then if it wasn't, all right? So there is some stuff like that, just to warn you. So anyway, by all means, let me know if you catch these things, because I can, you know, I know the people who maintain it, and then if they have another edition, we can try to get rid of that stuff. Okay, any other questions thus far? I think we've just been talking about that one, and I don't see any other things posted. Okay, Robert Rank says, can you talk a little bit about the subjective theory of value? Can value be objective somehow? I'm having trouble understanding. Okay, that's a great question. Yeah, I can certainly talk a little bit about that. And if just so you guys know, don't be afraid, how can I put it? Don't feel that you have to wait for me to finish and then say any more questions and then post the next one. So, because if you guys do have a bunch of questions and you start typing them, then I'll know how to pace myself. Because, I mean, I could talk for the next 40 minutes on subjective value theory, but if you guys have five different questions, I won't. So just keep that in mind. I can scroll back, you know, if you have one pending question, then hold off. But if you've got a question, go ahead and type it so I know how to pace myself. Okay, so subjective theory of value, so it's true. And Austrians in particular stressed the subjective theory of value more than I think any other major school of thought today. And so we pride ourselves on that, and so we really should know a lot about the subject because we emphasize it so much. And the Austrians will say, for example, that, yeah, the mainstream, they pay lip service to the subjective theory of value, but they don't embrace it the way we do, or you know, we take it to its consistent logical conclusion, whereas mainstream people don't. So there's a lot of different aspects to it. Let me just stress some of the big things. Okay, so the classical economists, and that, so for sure that means pre-1870, 1871, okay, because the standard break, you know, the dividing line between the classical period and then what would be after the so-called subjectivist or marginalist revolution is the publication all around the 1870, 1871, that era of three different things. So there was Karl Menger's Grundsatz, Principles of Economics is how we translate it. So that's, you know, Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, that was his first economic treatise. And that's if you want to date, where did Austrian economics get born, that's that book. And then William Stanley Jevons, I'm not going to remember the titles of his and the other guy's seminal works, but Jevons also, right in that same time, developed marginal utility theory as well, and then Leon Walras, okay? And so, and Walras's was very, it was much more mathematical, okay? So all three of them, if you consult a standard history of economic thought book, you know, not something that Austrians even put up, but just a standard, if you're going to take the history of economic thought course, you know, if you're studying economics, you might get a PhD and you're interested in the history, and you study the development of doctrines, they will credit Karl Menger as being one of the three guys who ushered in what is called the marginalist or subjectivist revolution. Okay, so what's the break? And I want to stress with this stuff, with economics, it's not like it's not like in with physics, and even in physics, it's not like Einstein completely invented this stuff off the top of his head. All right, the equations and things, and even the ideas that Einstein used in special relativity as compared to Newtonian mechanics, other people had thought of that stuff, and those equations came from a different guy. Okay, but what I'm saying is the break is a similar thing in economics, but even more so that it's not like the economists in the year 1865 had no idea about consumer valuation and how, you know, subjective preferences could influence market prices, right? So you don't want to fall into that caricature of thinking up until 1871, economists thought one way, and then bam, the next year they all thought differently. That's not the way it worked. But in terms of the frameworks that we associate with the classical school versus what could be called the neoclassical school, or you know, the post-revolutionaries, it is a totally different framework. Okay, so the classical approach to value, you know, when we talk about what do we mean by economic value, well, people mean different things by it, but it has to do with, you know, the importance people attribute to something, and you have to, you know, be clear, what do you mean by value? So one idea is market value. And so you might mean, when I talk about how can we explain value, I mean, why is it that a car has 10 times as much market value as a television set, and a house has a lot more market value than a car, and an hour of a surgeon's time is apparently a lot more valuable than an hour of a janitor's time, and so forth. Okay, so you're really talking about the price of certain things and what they can fetch in the market. Okay, so that's a huge component of what it is that economics is supposed to do, is to explain market prices. So the classical economists, so people like Adam Smith and David Ricardo and David Hume, even Frederick Bastiat, they by and large subscribe to a cost theory of value. And more specifically, and you know, people had their own nuances, but more specifically a labor theory of value. All right, so that's an interesting thing a lot of people don't realize. Karl Marx did not invent the labor theory of value. He took it from the classical economists. In fact, Marx himself could be classified as a classical economist. I mean, he's also a Marxist, but it's not that the socialists and the communists were sitting around and on their own dreamed up the labor theory of value. No, that was developed by the people we consider to be free market heroes. Okay? And in fact, Rothbard and some others hold that against Adam Smith. So how much of a free market guy could it be if he developed the labor theory of value that was the, you know, primary tool of the Marxists? Okay, so regardless of the ideology and everything, in terms of just the theory, the classical economists would say, you know, why you're trying to explain why is it that they would be talking about cars? Okay. Hey, you know what? I'm trying to teach these people. Okay.
So why don't you just wait where I'm almost done. No.
I'll get it to you later. Okay, sorry everybody. So the classical economists, they would look at something, I'm going to use modern examples just so we don't get mixed up. Obviously they wouldn't be talking about cars. We say, why is it that a car has 10 times as much market value as a television set, and they would say, oh, well, it's because, hang on, I got to usher more people in here. Sorry, everybody. It's an administrative thing that you got to do for some reason on this. Mm-hmm. Okay. For people who just joined us, you should now be up and running, okay? So let me just say that again. I just saw some people's mics going. So for people who just joined us, sorry for the delay if you were sitting in the queue there for a minute. It's a little bit of a clunky system. I have to manually switch people's statuses from attendee to panelist or something. So sorry about that if you were in limbo there for a while. But I think everyone's set right now. Okay, so the question is subjective theory of value. We're talking about the classical economists. So they want to explain why is it that a car has 10 times as much market value as a television set. They would probably have given an answer along these lines. They would say, well, look, it takes 10 times as much resources to make a car as to make a television set. And so in the long run, it has to be the case that a car has a market value or a market price of at least 10 times the television set, because if it didn't, in assuming the television set was, you know, had the correct equilibrium price, well, then you're losing money making the car, right? That you have to spend 10 times as much on resources building the car, and so if you're not getting remunerated 10 times as much in terms of the price, you're making less profit than the people who make cars, or make television sets, sorry. And so people would stop making cars. So in other words, if you're not covering your costs, you can't stay in business in the long run. Right? So that's how you know the price of a car has to be at least that much. But then why wouldn't it be a lot more? Why isn't it 50 times? And then they would just invoke competition. And they say, well, if the return to making cars is 300% and the return to making television sets is only 10%, you know, they've called it the rate of profit or something like that, well, then everyone's going to get into car production. And then the output goes up, and the price goes down until you restore that. Okay, so that was the basic type of argument they would give, that you know you have to cover your costs, and then there's competition, so that they, in the long run, the price that we would expect to prevail for a particular good or service is going to be that which covers all the costs of production, plus you know some markup for the interest on the invested capital. And then you can push that back and you say, okay, well, so all you're really telling me then is the price of a car is, I'll just make up numbers, $10,000 because it takes about, you know, $9,200 worth of materials and labor to make it, and then you need, you know, a little bit of a margin there for the risk and the interest on the invested capital. Okay. But clearly, the car couldn't sell for $9,000, at least not for very long, if it really cost $9,200 in materials and labor to make, because you're losing $200 a car. Why would anyone do that? But yet, it's also not going to cost $15,000, because that's a huge percentage markup, and you would get more people rushing to car production. Okay, but then they would push it back further. And you'd say, okay, but now why does it cost $9,200 in material and labor to make a car? And they'd say, well, some of the labor is steel and the windows and the rubber. And then you could ask, okay, so why does the steel cost, you know, X dollars per ton? And then they could use the same explanation. They could say, well, because if it costs less than that, the steel producers would go out of business. If it costs way more than that, they'd be making a killing and more people would go into steel production. All right, so for inanimate objects, you can just keep pushing it back. And just, you know, break down the pricing with those principles into the prices of the components that go into that thing. And it's not an infinite regress, they thought, because ultimately you're going to bump up against hiring human beings, right? That everything requires some labor input and then some other resources. And so the point is they would just keep pushing it back until the point at which you had explained everything by reference to those principles, except then you say, how do you get a laborer, you know, if a certain laborer requires $30 an hour, how do you, why is that the case? Why isn't it 25? Why isn't it 40? And there they would, you know, say, well, because he could just withhold his labor. You know, so that's why you need to offer it to him. And you know, there's also competition too, that if he's making a lot more, other people would rush into it if they had the skills. Okay, so that's So that's why the cost theory of value actually, for a lot of the classical economists, reduced to a labor theory of value, because they were just, you know, everything else was just sort of a stepping stone or a halfway point. And then you would ultimately, hang on, we got more people who joined us, and I'm going to not leave them hanging. And so you'd ultimately explain it that way. Oops, there we go. So then the so now the subjectivist marginalist revolution comes through, and the question is, what's wrong with what we just said? There's lots of things wrong. Let me just give you some quick things. So for people who are just joining us, if you have questions, go ahead and post them in the chat box, and I'll wrap up my discussion. But for right now, I'm not seeing anything, so I'm pontificating. So the question for those of you just joined, we're comparing the classical versus the subjective theory of value. So the classical adhere to an objective cost or labor theory of value. So the subjectivist economists who relied on marginal utility, they said that no, all you guys have really done, and one of the Bumbavrakas is fabulous on this. That he wrote just some excellent stuff. I mean, I know a lot of people don't read Bumbavrak because he is a difficult writer, but if you can get into his style, he really, I think, if you want to see the development of subjective value theory, I think Bumbavrak is the person to read. I keep meaning to review his classic work on that for Mises.org, and I haven't gotten around to doing it yet. But anyway, partly because we take it now for granted. Like, I don't think I could explain subjective value theory better than Bumbavrak could, because I don't even have to worry about the objections that he did since they were developing it. You know what I mean? Like, he was still arguing with people, trying to get them to become subjectivists, whereas now it's just taken for granted, so we don't have to ever make the case for it. And so we're not as good at it as they would have been back then when it was a new thing. So anyway, some of the problems with the cost or labor theory of value, there's a bunch. For one thing, it's not really explaining the actual determination of a particular market price, right? So if you go out in the market and see that the price of a car is, you know, $9,500, it doesn't, but by talking about the things that I talked about 5 minutes ago, you're not actually telling me why is that price $9,500. All you're doing really is setting a lower and an upper bound and saying, well, in the long run, it's got to be in between these two, this floor and the ceiling, for these reasons I'm giving. But that's not the question. The question is, why is it $9,500 right now? Because, you know, if there was an overproduction of cars and the dealer is sitting on a bunch of cars that he can't get rid of, he might lower the price below the cost of production, right? He might suffer a loss just to get him off his lot. Okay, so what the subjectivist marginalists were trying to do is they were trying to say, no, we want to explain the actual market price at any given day, not just talk about the long run limit price, which is what the classical approach really would give you. So that's what they're trying to do, and they say as a bonus, you know, so you're not losing any of that knowledge. You can still talk about the fact that producers aren't going to stay in an industry if they're losing money in the long term, and they're not, and you're, and if somebody's making above average returns without taking on a bunch of risk, then other people will flock into it. I mean, you still have those principles as subjectivist, but what you are explaining is the spot price on any given moment. And so they started from the consumer side. So that's one difference there, is that the subjectivist marginalists, they begin from the fact that goods are useful. That's where the word utility, usefulness, comes from, and that's where they start. So the classical school, you know, they understood that people's valuations were important, but they tended to focus on the supply side, on the, you know, the production and the technology, whereas the subjectivists, hence the name, where they thought, no, really the essence of what's going on when we see prices is that people mentally are evaluating something and appraising it with their minds, and that's what the source of value is. It's a human being's appraisal of how useful something is to him, how important it is. That's the source of value. Now, it's true, you've got these other empirical conditions and things that could influence your valuation process, but they're saying what makes that price $9,200 or whatever it is, it is human beings valuing things. That's where the price comes from. And then their valuations in turn might be influenced by these other things that the classicals talk about. Oh, thanks, buddy. We're going to be done in a little bit, buddy, okay? All right, so let me just very quickly give you some of the objections and some of the problems with okay, so I see Derek has posted a question. So again, if you guys have questions, go ahead and post them, and I'll be more brief with this answer. So the couple of problems. Okay, let's say you're walking in the woods and you see a television set on the ground that somebody just left there. And holy cow. And you pick it up and you're a producer and you want to go and sell it, you're going to be able to get a market price for it and set a price, even though you just found that thing. You don't know how many labor hours went into it. Okay? You're gonna charge more than the time it took you to pick the thing up off the floor and bring it to the store. Okay, so you're gonna make a huge rate of return on that particular unit. All right, and so that's, you know, just trying to get you to see when people are setting prices, the costs of production at that point are gone. They're sunk costs. It's irrelevant. Okay, and so that's where the subjectivist margins are coming in. They're trying to get you to see what determines the actual prices we see in the marketplace are not determined by historical facts. They're determined at that moment by subjective decisions. So they're, you know, how useful is this thing? How much are people willing to pay for it? That kind of stuff. You know, and that's the way you would determine how do you price something that you just found in the forest. You wouldn't need to, you know, because the classical school, it's not that they would say this, but it's sort of like an implication of their general approach, is that if you didn't know how, you know, if we found this TV set and it's really cool, it's got an amazing picture and so forth, if we don't know how many hours went into its production, how do we know how much to charge for it? You see, so it's not, the problem is the classical school, it gave this idea that value was this objective thing that flowed from labor and flowed from resources into consumer goods. And what Carl Menger in particular did is he said, no, it's the other way around. People value first and foremost those lower order, first order consumer goods. And then since we know how much those things have, how much value they have, we impute the value up the structure of production to the second order goods, to the third order goods, and so on. So it's not that value goes from the factors into the final product, it's the other way around. Consumers directly value the final products, and then once we know how consumers feel about those products, we as producers can then start appraising the materials and the workers that are used to make them. So a pithy illustration of that is to say, if you're thinking of a cost of production theory, you might say, oh man, why is it that I'm trying to think of a good example. Why is it that it costs so much for if you leave a Broadway show in Manhattan, you know, you're literally on Broadway and you go and see a show, and then you go out and you go across the street to a restaurant there, and why is it that it's so expensive? You know, it's like $20 to get a hamburger at a diner that's across the street from a Broadway production. Why is it so expensive? The sort of cost of production view would say, oh, well, because real estate's that expensive. And so they have to charge that much, otherwise they'd go out of business. You know, if the diner is going to be there, they need to charge $20, $25 a hamburger to be able to pay the landlord because their rent is so high. And so that's the cost of production mentality. But really, no. The real, you know, the starting point answer is No, because the reason people are, it's because consumers are willing to pay that much. People want to go to New York. Tourists want to go to New York because, ah, it's New York. It's famous. There's amazing shows. And then, you know, given that you're in a, just came out of a Broadway show, if you want to eat, you're willing to go pay $25 for that hamburger, you know, that on your value scale. Whereas that couldn't happen in Topeka, Kansas. You couldn't just say, oh, let's have real estate prices be as high as they are in New York, and then all the diners in Topeka, Kansas are going to be able to charge $25 for a hamburger. If they tried that, what would happen? People would stop going to those diners. They'd go out of business. And then the owners of that land would realize we can't possibly ask people to pay the rental price, you know, the mortgage or the, you know, the fee for using our land that owners of real estate in New York can get away with. And then those prices would come down. Okay, so it's true. I mean, it's not wrong to say of the diner across the street from a Broadway show, they need to charge $25 for a hamburger in order to stay in business. That's a true statement, but that's not the end of the story. Because you have to push it back and say, why is it that in New York, across the street from Broadway, real estate prices are so high? And that's not because of just other costs. That's because people subjectively prefer to do things in New York. Like tourists would rather go to New York than go to Topeka, Kansas. And so that's what's pushing up all the prices across the board. That's what's supporting such a high so-called cost of living. Okay, Derek Dixon says, Dr. Murphy, what's your thoughts on the standard ADAS model that every undergrad sees in their intermediate macro classes? Okay, so Derek is talking about the aggregate demand, aggregate supply model. I don't think it's good. At this point, if you're going to go to college and take and become an economics major, you have to see that just because so many other economists use that framework, so you have to know what they're talking about. But I don't think it's good. I think the problem with those aggregate demand, aggregate supply models is that it completely, I seem to have a little redhead behind me, is that they don't include capital theory. I mean, theoretically, you could believe in capital theory and then use those models as a shorthand to answer particular questions, but I think in general they're very misleading and harmful. And the people who use that framework, like Paul Krugman does, as the workhorse, you know, the way to start thinking through things, I think is wrong. So if you're just thinking of, well, the economy, you know, it has certain technological supply capabilities, you know, production functions and things, and certain demand, and then, gee, if we're in a period where output is below trend and prices are low, well, it must be because we don't have enough demand. If we could just get people to spend more, that would pump up demand, and the only issue would be if people start overspending and there's too much demand, well, then we see prices go up. You know, that's the kind of stuff you get from the aggregate demand, aggregate supply model, and I think that for one thing, there's only one price. And that, you know, if you just have an ASAD, there can only be one price. And so when you say, well, is aggregate demand too high? You say, well, is there a big price inflation? And that's the kind of stuff they do. And so that totally obscures relative prices. Like, so in the Austrian approach to the business cycle, it's not whether prices are going up or down. It's no, during the boom period, you know, the prices of the higher order goods are going up faster than the prices of the consumer goods. And so that's what stimulates entrepreneurs to expand those higher order stages. And then in the bust, it's the other way around. Those higher order stages collapse. So it's not just a matter of what happens to CPI. It's the prices of different goods depending where they are in the structure of production. And so in an aggregate demand, aggregate supply frame, when you lose all, you just lump everything together. So I think that's a major problem with that. So like I say, it might be useful for particular things, but especially like we're in the midst of a recession or a recovery or what have you, I don't think it's a good idea. I think it's misleading because it completely obscures the structure of production. And so we, so for those of you who stick around, we'll get into all that stuff. Not this, we won't talk about the business cycle in this particular course, but we will get to that stuff. But anyway, that would be my answer for you. Other questions? We got about 15 minutes. I don't think I missed anybody's question. If not, I can say more about the subjective stuff. All right, so I'll say some more stuff about the subjective value theory, but again, if you guys have questions, just post them and I'll field those. So just a couple more problems with the objective cost theory approach. I mean, the standard one is, look, if I'm going to say, oh, the reason that car costs $9,500 is that ultimately there's $9,500 worth of labor that went into it. So again, there's like $1,000 of labor right away, the guys, you know, assembling the final parts and so on. But then when you ask where those parts come from, well, there was labor that went into those and so on. So that's what I mean, the labor theory of value. At each stage, you can see how much labor went into it, and then the other remaining materials you decompose and you say, well, where'd they come from? And ultimately there was labor. So the idea is, you know, nature doesn't charge us to use her stuff. The only factor that you really have to compensate to convince to work for you is human labor. That's the idea. So one problem with that is to say, well, wait a minute. If you're ultimately explaining prices by saying how much labor went into it, well, what if everybody just took twice, well, everyone tied their hand behind their back, and so it took twice as long for people to do everything, that wouldn't make things all of a sudden twice as valuable. Okay, so it's not like Adam Smith would have said, oh my gosh, you just blew up my world. You know, I mean, they weren't stupid. I don't mean to suggest that. I just got yelled at because I used the S word. They weren't silly, but the point is, just the very framework, the basic thrust of a cost theory of production, if you're going to explain things by saying, oh, the reason that car ultimately costs 10 times as much or has a price 10 times as high as the TV is that 10 times as much labor power went into the car, well, then yeah, Jan, I can see your types. Yeah. Then, you know, it's if it's, you're saying it's because it has 10 times as stuff, as much labor power that went into it, then what if those people, you know, just worked harder? Okay, or going the other way, what if they found a new way to do it and they could economize on labor? All of a sudden the car would go down in price? Well, no, it wouldn't. I mean, it would still be valuable. Okay, so the point is, you have these general rules of thumb that are true in the long run with the labor theory of value, but you're actually not directly explaining price formation. Whereas once you understand the subjectivist marginalist approach, you can explain, you know, 3 p.m. on a Sunday, why was the price of those tomatoes such and such per pound? You can explain that. And then you can also explain why in the long run is the price of tomatoes going to be such and such. Okay, so you can, it's really, I think, a classic example of progress in an intellectual discipline, in this case economics, right? Just like Newtonian or special relativity and general relativity could explain everything that Newtonian mechanics could and more, by the same token, subjectivist marginal price theory can explain everything that the classicals could, and it can explain a whole lot more, and the framework is just more comprehensible. If you guys Google Robert Murphy critique of Kevin Carson, and his name is spelled like Johnny Carson, C-A-R-S-O-N, you can see there's a lot more on that. Oh. I wrote up a paper talking about, okay, buddy, the difference between the cost and subjective value theory. Okay, Jan says, economics is a subset of praxeology. What is the difference between them, and what are the other subsets besides economics? I was hoping you wouldn't ask that, Jan. I'm not going to work. Okay. So the part of the problem is the reason I didn't give you guys a crisp answer, because you're right, that's a natural question. If I stress in the lecture economics is a subset of praxeology, then say, well, what, why isn't the whole thing, what's the difference, and then also what else is in this thing called praxeology. The reason I didn't give you a formal definition of economics is I think it's Austrians don't define it consistently. Okay, for, I'm almost positive when I did the study guide for human action, I ran into that problem. That Mises, in the beginning of the book, defined economics one way, and then later in the book, he defined it a little bit differently. And so, you know, it's you know, unfortunately, it's not like a class run by a mathematician where they give you formal definitions and it's pretty obvious what's where. So praxeology is the study of human action. So it's anything that you can deduce logically from the fact that people act, where act is used in the Misesian sense, that falls under praxeology. Economics is, okay, Lewis says is Cadillac, it's the same as economics. In certain parts, Lewis, and this is where I'm getting at in terms of the inconsistency, that at times Mises almost talks like economics is the same thing as praxeology, whereas at other times, so for sure, catalactics, here's the issue, guys. If you, at some point, you might describe economics as the study of exchange. Okay, and that seems like, oh, okay, yeah, that's more narrowly economic. But no, because you can also argue that praxeology, that anybody who acts is trying to exchange a less satisfactory for a more satisfactory condition. Okay, so in that sense, praxeology is the study of exchange. Okay, and you don't want to say that economics is the study of market exchanges, because then Robinson Crusoe economics wouldn't fall under economics. Right, because there's not a market with Robinson Crusoe on his island, but yet clearly he has means and ends, and he has natural resources and labor and an income and capital and savings and investment, but there's no market. Okay, so you don't want to say economics is the study of market exchange. All right, so I'm just showing you that you have to be careful how you define things so that you make sure something that clearly is economics gets under that umbrella, but yet you don't define economics so broadly that it's basically the same thing as praxeology. So, let's see. So, catalactics, how much time we got? 6 minutes. Let me try to give you guys a good answer. I want to just go Google this and make sure I don't say something wrong. Let me see if I can find. Yeah, see, if you just go to regular thing, it says catalactics is the science of exchanges, a branch of political economy. Okay, but again, the science of exchanges, that could be praxeology. All right, that's not an Austrian thing. Okay, so let me see. But if you go and check Mises. Let's see. For Mises, a lot of times he uses the term catalactics to be interchangeable with economics. All right. At least one spot, I believe, in Human Action, Mises says catalactics is the study of exchange when there's money. Okay, so that is a very narrow thing. He said, okay, now we're talking about when there's money. So, but again, you got to be careful, because if you're going to say that, well, then even barter exchange isn't catalactics, and clearly that's economics. Okay, so if you're going to say catalactics is the study of exchanges involving money, then catalactics is itself a narrower subset than even economics. All right, so So I'm hoping I'm not making you guys roll your eyes. I'm just explaining to you why I can't give you a crisp answer, because I've seen, I think even in the same book, namely Human Action, that Mises sometimes used terms not quite consistently. As far as if you want to say, okay, we're not sure, you know, what's the definition of economics, Cadillacs, and so on, but give me something, Bob, that's in praxeology, but that's not in economics or catalactics. A praxeological analysis of violence. You know, so Rothbard gets into that in, does he do it in chapter 12? I can't remember. He does it in the combined Man, Economy, and State, and Power, and Market, but I can't remember if he does it a little bit in the last chapter of MES, or if he totally pushes it back into Power and Market. But there, I mean, so you can talk about, you know, so Rothbard praxeologically analyzes the different categories of aggression. Okay, and so that is not economics, because in economics we're assuming that there's property rights and there's exchanges and things like that. Okay, so Derek is saying that it is an MES. What, just so you guys know, if you didn't read the introduction to the Scholar's Edition, Rothbard originally wrote the whole thing. So the big fat book that you have is what's now called, and he thinks big fat book is funny, that you view as, you know, Man, Economy, State plus Power and Market. My understanding is Rothbard wrote that whole thing as one big manuscript. But then when he tried to get it published, the people who were, you know, funding it and everything were like, whoa, because he, you know, gets into anarcho-capitalism and Power and Market. And so I think they were like, you know what, why don't we just focus on the economics? And so then I think the compromise was with Robert. Said, well, you got to let me talk about government intervention. They said, okay. And so then he made what we now know of as the last chapter of Man, Economy, and State was the stuff from Power and Market that he distilled and sort of, you know, took out the anarchist, the explicitly anarchist stuff, to not scare grandma. All right, so that's why a lot of the stuff that's in Power and Market is in condensed form in the last chapter of Man, Economy, and State. Okay, on that note, I think we should probably wrap it up. So thank you guys for attending. For those of you who joined and were like in limbo over there for a minute, I apologize for that. That shouldn't happen again. And remember to do your quizzes if you're taking the course for credit, and I'll see you guys on Wednesday. Okay, thanks, everybody.
Now, are you all done?